Greetings, podcast listeners, and welcome to the April edition of the Colorado Review podcast. My name is Daniel Schoening.
And I'm Evan Senny.
Joining us today is associate editor here at the Center for Literary Publishing, Kristen McIntyre. Welcome, Kristen.
Hi, Danny.
Today we're going to do a little AWP recap. As the three of us have just returned from Portland, we're going to talk about the spring issue of Colorado Review and hopefully read a few excerpts from all three genres therein. Stick with us.
So the three of us just got back from the AWP conference. For me and Danny, it was the first time. For Kristen, it was the second time. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, how did you like it? And was it any different from last year?
I think this year, since it was my second visit to AWP, which can be so overwhelming. My very first visit was very overwhelming. Mm. There's so many panels and you want to do everything. And the book fair is just like Mecca for all of us writers. Mm-hmm. I was a little shell-shocked the first time. And this time I went in with less plans and more of an attitude of like, oh, I'll just see what happens. So I didn't attend as many panels as I would have if I would have scoured the schedule and mm-hmm. looked through it, but I think it worked out just perfect.
Yeah, I think Portland's a wonderful place for being not at the conference. the conference itself was wonderful, and I especially liked tabling for Colorado Review and getting to meet some of our wonderful contributors who just came up and said they were excited to be in the next issue or in previous issues. But it was equally nice to wander and maybe not be in that big bubble for a little while.
So true.
I definitely felt that. I was a little bit ill for most of it, but still had a great time. And in particular, I enjoyed Benjamin Swallow came by. Mm. And I love his story, Bouche Bourgeois. And it was really cool to meet him. He was wonderful. And I think that's a really valuable thing, working at Colorado Review, getting to meet the people who just wrote the really wonderful pieces that you got to read and put out in the world.
Well said. I met Benjamin as well, and he was so fantastic to chat with him and just kind of meet him after reading his story that I too so loved. And that's just kind of the great gift of AWP. That was great. Mm-hmm.
As this episode is going to be mostly taking a look at the luminous works included in our spring 2019 edition of Colorado Review, we're going to begin with a look at one of our nonfiction selections entitled One Man's Poison by Kyoko Mori. Mori's piece, just to give a bit of framing that the writer herself gives, begins, "Before my mother's suicide, the year I turned 12, my father and I seldom saw each other." And even in that sentence, it's I think it gives profound and meaningful context for the kinds of things that are being explored in the piece itself. In the excerpt that I'm reading now, we get a sense of the writer's after-the-fact interrogation of her mother's suicide, of the circumstances that led to that event, and how the speaker at present is contending with those things that might then be inherited, passed on to her body, to herself. Although my mother was never officially diagnosed, the idea of seeking a medical intervention added to her feelings of failure and shame. It's clear that she suffered from some form of depression. Other women of her generation, including the poets Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton, had also killed themselves, leaving behind their children. As a young woman studying to be a writer in the decades after their deaths, I feared that someday I might find myself sitting in a dark kitchen, going over all the ways in which I had wasted my life and become a failure. I didn't think any of these women had been killed by their writing, but the introspection required to compose poems, or diary entries in my mother's case, was difficult and dangerous work. You couldn't write anything true, complex, or beautiful unless you were willing to examine the unsettling thoughts in your own head. You had to force yourself to contemplate the random nature of the world and the limitations of human goodness. Getting depressed might be an occupational hazard. I wondered how I could be like these smart, creative women, my actual mother and my literary mothers, without inheriting their fate. As that excerpt elucidates, this piece is absolutely incisive. It is so unique in its language and laid quite bare in its both this the structure of each sentence, of the thoughts being provided, in the window that it provides to the speaker's crisis, but also reaches these conclusions that feel ubiquitous, that feel felt by everyone regardless of how close they've been to a tragedy like this, that they contend not only with that loss and that distance and the sense that one has of creating a self from a childhood, no matter what it was, but also the worry of inheritance, of a set future that's determined by a past that wasn't even yours. And I think all of these things come through beautifully in the work itself.
It seems like it also does a really nice job of working with something that can be a really poisonous thing, the idea of a tortured genius and how it has to be that way for work to be good. But I think the honesty here and the questioning was a delicate and insightful way to go about that difficult question.
Yeah, Evan, you said something that I was thinking of while listening to Danny read the excerpt. And you said the word question. And to me, this excerpt lets loose so many questions and doesn't pretend really to answer them, which is really refreshing and really insightful to question the writer's kind of relationship to their own work and the writer's relationship to mother and to things like this that are always floating around in my head, but I never quite get to.
Mm-hmm. And one has a hard time thinking of a more loaded, difficult, potentially hazardous thing about which to write than such fraught familial relationships, especially because I think these circumstances, especially in creative nonfiction, often we reveal in these pieces more than we intend to, or we discover something in ourselves on the page that might not be the most flattering, might not be the most joyful. And instead of being coy or circling around that crisis in an effort to avoid it, this piece moves directly through it, writes through it, speaks through it, thinks through it, and allows those conclusions about the speaker's present day, the speaker's present concept of what makes a family and what she wants for herself in the world, all come to a full conclusion, a full explanation, without there being any neat bow tied at the end. These questions that you're right are posed so wonderfully, Kristen, remain at the close, and yet we feel we've made meaningful headway in them. And the particular narrative of this speaker in reference to her father, her mother, her brother, her stepmother, all culminates in this what is essentially an exploration of the self. And I think it's a fair estimation to say that that's something I look for in all good creative nonfiction, is turning that lens back on the self, on the speaker, finding in them something that they didn't know was there before, and bringing the audience along for that ride.
Yeah, that's really exciting to me as a novice nonfiction reader. Those are the qualities that I love so much about poetry and good poetry, or what I respond to in poems. And to find that here is really exciting. Sometimes I think about something that you said, Danny, which is that the piece moves into the crisis rather than the piece kind of healing itself. The piece is written to keep the wound open, mm-hmm. And to honor that space, and you know, in order to move through it, which is fantastic.
Agreed. And I think in addition to these concepts and questions surrounding family being potentially fraught, I think in creative nonfiction they also often run the risk of being exclusive, that the person writing them either feels nostalgia or a personal trauma, the particulars of which are known only to them or felt only by them, such that the reader is always felt at arm's length. I think one of the things that Maury does so beautifully here is welcomes in, generously opens a door to this experience, and then allows this experience to be an access point for something deeper, for something more fundamental, in addition to its merit, its value, its kind of heartbreak as a particular, I think it really accesses its audience on the level of the general.
We were actually just talking about this in fiction workshop last night. Our professor, E.J. Levy, pointed out that if you start at the level of the universal, it indicates that the subject almost has to be something about cyclicality, because it's actually not the best way to achieve universal connection, that the best way to achieve that connection is through the particular.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this essay does a great job of that. It makes those connections, but it does it by starting really close, and then allows us to take what it's telling us and make it our own.
As an MFA candidate in poetry, and soon to leave us quite tragically, Kristen McIntyre has chosen a few poems from the spring issue that spoke especially to her, and she's going to start with her first selection.
Thank you, Danny. My first selection is a poem called Luxury by Albert Abinado. Luxury. Today, I do not think about death, not the brittle skulls of children or the metal in their blood that could pass for bullets. I do not think about the bones of birds or the blackberry seeds left over in the belly. The time a muscle takes to go blue from a deflated lung, not the bright jaws of insects that come for the flesh, the meat. I do not think of grief as a color on my aunt's tongue, her face a country of fires. I do not think about kissing my grandfather in his coffin, not the temperature of his lips. Today, I lose count. I forget about sorrow and its teeth, about regret and its prickled skin. I forget how to pray for the dead I do not have to bury, forget that hymns turn my mouth into a sun, that terror can be the same word for skin or brain. Forget that I do not speak Chinese, that I must correct anyone who asks if I speak Chinese, must say no, I am afraid I am Filipino, must say I do not speak Tagalog either. I do not ask anyone to forgive me for forgetting, and this is the oldest joy. Let me forget that I cannot hold the moon to feed it peppers when I want, that the rain in the trees is not rapture, is not applause for the rose on my shoes, that I do not blister and crack from holiness. Today I am holy, and when I split my lip on the fist of my brother that was holy too, and when I kneel in the center of an empty parking lot, I do so grateful I can taste my blood. What I love so much about this poem is that the poem thinks through forgetting in a way that leaves the speaker at the end with something so singular, which is the body and the blood and the mouth. But in order to get to that kind of singular space, all of this forgetting must take place. And so the poem is so overwhelmed by death and sorrow and grief, and children and all these kind of stunning images that the speaker must eventually forget in order to be present in the body and to kind of taste the blood of oneself, which is so kind of moving to me.
Mm-hmm. And the way that it arrives there is so stunning too. I think that much perhaps to the surprise of those listening that aren't seeing the poem on the page, it does participate in a lot of the formal, traditional logic of poetry, down to that pivot that takes place in its volta when we move from a I do not to today I am holy. That combined with the ways by which the line break is utilized to double and triple meaning throughout, like across kissing my grandfather, line break in his coffin, not the bright jaws, line break of insects, that image is set up and then subverted, set up and then subverted. And that kind of cause and effect, that established object and then a reversal of that object is then reified in the macro poem itself, where we turn, pivot. And that pivoting is such a fruitful thing, operating both in what you've just heard, but also on the page. So I hope those listening get a chance to see the poem itself.
Yeah, and that technique is of using the line break to reveal the many or the image that was there but couldn't be seen in a traditional sentence, or if the break wasn't present, mm-hmm. is such a deft move mm-hmm. in a poem that thinks through the manied and the overwhelm. For the poem to enact that through its line break is really, it's just a stunning move.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked the lines, "And when I split my lip on the fist of my brother, that was holy too." And I liked it because it seemed to be its own kind of reversal, where it seemed to be giving the lip the agency that you would normally give to the fist.
Yeah, there's so many tight moves like that. The poem feels contained to me too, as it opens with blood and ends with blood.
Mm-hmm.
Opens with not the brittle skulls of children or the metal in their blood that could pass for bullets. And then that final line, "I can taste my blood."
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice move.
And within that earliest movement of the poem, or those earliest series of movements, are ones that operate largely on the level of color, that the blood is that early shade of red, moving to the blackberry, to the blue from a deflated lung, grief as a color on my aunt's tongue. And that kind of panoply slowly reduces down until we're more singularly, more sparely settled in that image in the parking lot at close. For those interested in reading along, you can find this poem and others at the Colorado Review website at coloradoreview.colostate.edu.
The next poem that I'll read is a poem called "Migration" by Laura Paul Watson. "Migration for tea. Butterflies thick at the eaves circled the house made big without him. Flew in and out the open door. One at the window fluttered at my hands as I carried it outside again, its long heart beating, its thick flight cupped. I tried to track it, how its body hinged as it broke away, how it stitched the sky through which it flew. But there were so many, and the many of them so colored, I lost it among the others, and the others among the leaves, their gallery, since they, too, had cast themselves into the perfect day." And I want to say, too, just before I talk about a little bit about why I like this poem so much, that there's a little cohort of like three of us at Colorado Review that have lovingly called Laura Paul Watson LP Watts. We circulated this poem quite a bit between the couple of us. So Laura, if you're listening, you have some serious fans.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure many outside of Colorado Review.
Absolutely. But what I love so much about this poem is that it's so small, and I mean that in the highest compliment. It's so small and so tight and so simple, but it breaks open such profound questions, and not unlike "Luxury," which we just read. This poem works with the many and the one, with the day and with what's kind of kept and lost in these particular movements.
And it is so small and so gently delivered. That line, its long heart beating, its thick flight cupped. What a strange and transcendent image of long heart. That onomatopoeic quality of cupped at close of sentence and stanza. These are every line, every word, every stanza feels like it's making the house, it's making the butterfly. It's so beautifully enacting those movements that it's also commenting upon.
And these neat little tercets and that final single line, mm-hmm. As the full tercet just kind of gets lost and can only be one final line that reads into the perfect day, mm-hmm. Their form and content working so nicely together.
And even that first line, butterflies thick at the eaves, demands that us also imagine butterflies themselves having eaves, themselves seeing what the imagistic rhyming is occurring between the house that they're dwelling on and encircling and the bodies themselves, that there's this attention to the way that the intra conversation among images is heightened and as heightened as possible in such a spare and thoughtful poem. And I think it's worth mentioning also what a wonderful thing it is to receive a joyful poem and one devoted so much to beauty, that there's real place for poems that grapple with the difficult and the grim and the grisly. But this is just such a wonderful, transcendent experience to be able to settle in this poem and conceive of the world that it's offering us.
Yeah, that's so nicely said, Danny, and I agree with that wholeheartedly. And another thing that I'm really impressed by with this poem is that the eye appears so sparingly. The main images for me as a reader are butterfly, house, and sky, mm-hmm. and that fantastic image at the end with the leaves, their gallery, and the butterflies kind of disappearing there. But the eye does so little. Mm-hmm. It carries the butterfly, it tracks the butterfly, and ultimately it loses the butterfly. But surrounding that, there is more importance kind of happening.
Yeah, both the hymn and the eye are themselves bodies that are lost in the leaves and the many other considerations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know very little about poetry and have no craft reason for this, but the line, how it stitched the sky through which it flew, I just find lovely to read. I like the images. I like the way it rolls off the tongue. I just thought it was really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I did too. I think that there, the wing and the butterfly are transformed into this entity that is then making the sky, and that reversal is just so apt and so poignant and so pointed that it speaks.
And on a craft level, it slips into those iams that themselves are stitching. It stitched the sky through which it flew, you know, another enactment of form.
That's what I meant to say.
As ever at Colorado Review and the Center for Literary Publishing, there is lots and lots going on in addition to this wonderful podcast.
We have two recent books of poetry that you can purchase on the website under the bookstore tab. One is a book by Gillian Cummings called The Owl Was a Baker's Daughter, and the other is Adam Fagan's Furthest Ecology. There you will also find the Spring 2019 issue of Colorado Review.
We at the Center for Literary Publishing are also pleased to announce that Brandon Krieg's Magnifier was chosen by Judge Kazem Ali as winner of the 2019 Colorado Prize for Poetry. This title will be available in November of this year at that same bookstore tab on the Colorado Review website. Finally, look also to the website for your weekly dose of blogs, book reviews, and miscellanea that are worth your time and attention. To wrap up our exploration of the three genres featured in this issue, Evan Senny is going to read a segment from Amanda Ajamfar's piece, Little Sister.
I'm going to start by reading the very short first paragraph of the piece, and then I'm going to read an excerpt from later in the story. Around 9 p.m., my mother calls and calls and calls. Finally, I pick up, and she heaves through the phone. She set herself on fire. I wanted to start with that because I was struck reading this piece by how unusual a premise it is. The premise is that our protagonist is reflecting on the death of her sister who died via self-immolation as part of an environmental protest. And it was interesting, you normally get a much quieter opening, and I felt that this was a good hook, but it also made me a little bit suspicious because I wondered if it's such a loud opening and such a great hook, will it be only that or will it deepen? And part of the reason I chose this story is that I think it deepens beautifully. And I'll read this next section and then talk about the ways in which I think it does that. To help orient the reader, I want to say that the she mentioned in this next section is referring to the sister and is referring to the suicide note that she left. She's widely criticized for not providing solutions, only accusations. That's what even those who agree with her complain about, the extremeness of what she did and its lack of efficacy. She asked only that people pay attention and change and stop. Nothing concrete, the same old pleas that have never worked, and nothing in it was addressed to us, no apologies or instructions. It feels like she did what she did in a kind of vacuum, not as herself, but just as a human willing to die to get some attention for something everyone already knows. I chose to read this section because I found this to be one of the more poignant moments in this story, in part because a lot of what this is about is the protagonist worrying about her role in her sister's life. And in this case, it comes in the form of her questioning her sister's motives and the efficacy of this act, but also sort of the efficacy of acting at all. And I think it's representative of what the piece is trying to do. And other examples of that include a framing device that's used in this piece, which is that there are cell phone videos of the immolation. And we keep getting those videos from different angles as the protagonist tries to understand a way to see this event and her sister's life and her own life in a way that is comprehensible and in a way that she could sort out such that she could find a way that she's comfortable living.
And for Ajamfar, the act of self-immolation in this piece acts as a literalized beacon for injustice, for tragedy, for loss, for things to which people's attention otherwise would not be turned. And so for it to be something that's not dislocated from the person reading about it or experiencing it, for it to be something so intimate as a family member engaging in it, I think turns that convention on its head to meaningful ends.
And this piece seems interested in interrogating the way that thing that we normally think of as far away or something that we see at a distance can end up being very close. And I think that it asks the question of how one can be burdened or lessen one's burden through looking. And the device of the videos and a picture that comes up at an important moment questions whether one can reframe something such that it's no longer unbearable.
And within that, it seems also interested in that unknown and what is known. That excerpt that you read as well says, for something that we all already know, that a person sacrifices themselves to draw attention to what might not be a revelation. But then the speaker and the speaker's family continues over the course of the work to receive different snippets, different points of view, different perspectives on the event, so that they themselves are accumulating more and more of what they know and why it happened and how it happened. That concurrent to the speaker growing in her understanding of her sister as a person prior to that event. Those snapshots accumulate and grow and grow and grow. And so I think it says something also about it's an epistemological question that's being probed as much as it is a phenomenological one, as much as it is one of media and point of view. I think there's so much being provided in the vehicle of this story.
And what might ultimately be haunting is that all they have are those snippets of media. And so if there's a revelation to be had, it has to be in there somewhere. And so all one can do is look.
What a fantastic piece and a wonderful collection of pieces. If those listening heard anything that they like or hated everything that they heard, there are many more pieces of creative nonfiction, fiction, and poetry in the latest issue. And they really, the other two here can vouch for this, run the gamut in terms of the different forms and types of writing that can be engaged in each genre. Kristen, it was such a pleasure to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me both, Danny and Evan. It was such a joy to be here.
This has been Daniel Shonen.
And Evan Senny.
As ever, we are grateful as can be to Stephanie Geschwind, the editor-in-chief of Colorado Review and all-around leader of the Center for Literary Publishing.
We're also grateful to Arnie Geschwind, who composed the wonderful music that you heard on this episode.
Happy National Poetry Month, all those listening. On behalf of all the poets here at the Center for Literary Publishing, thank you for your support. We hope to have you back here in May.